It's become an unfunny joke. No matter what crucial intellectual property gets developed in the United States, it gets stolen by China or maybe Russia. A special team deep in the Defense Department has been working on one strategy to counteract this. It looks for investments in U.S. companies by suspicious foreigners. For his work collaborating with so many other federal agencies, the team leader is a finalist in this year's Service to America Medals program, the Deputy Director of the Office of Foreign Investment Review at DOD, David Rader, joins me now. Mr. Rader, good to have you on.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Good to be here.
So tell us about the Office of Foreign Investment Review and what you do on that team, how the whole thing works.
Yeah, you bet. Foreign Investment Review, or FIR as we call it, in large part is the CFIUS office. So that's the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. That's a very narrow kind of structured regulatory process. But what we've discovered is a lot of things that pose threats to national security fall outside of CFIUS itself. And so I built a team of data scientists and economists, lawyers, former program managers and project officers, if you will, to really look at sticky national security issues in the financial and economic domain that are kind of non-traditional, but pose a great risk to us.
And you say financial and economic domain that are non-traditional. Maybe explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, traditionally, the department or, you know, national security apparatuses writ large never look at economics as a function of warfighting or a warfighting domain or an area of exploitation. It's generally viewed as something kind of separate. And so taking that approach or using that lens to look at transactions and what that means for national security is a primary focus of ours.
And do you focus on investments in technology companies or potential suppliers to the Defense Department, or do you look at the economy in a larger sense?
Yeah, it's an unfair answer, but it's everything. So we look at macroeconomic data to kind of see where the market's moving directionally. Then we'll look at specific transactions, to your point, in emerging critical or disruptive technologies, all the way to core military systems that you're used to protecting. But the world is shifting and civil and military fusion is occurring around the world, both organically and inorganically. And so semiconductors and thrusters and rockets and lasers, you know, for cutting in factories or materials are all, you know, playing a role in national security and our defense platforms.
So you're looking for transactions then that would indicate someone that we don't want investing in one of these companies investing in it.
Exactly. And relationships. And, you know, some of our adversaries are pretty clever. They use some obfuscated ownership or opaque structures to extract technology and try to replicate it or just take it overseas. So joint ventures, the relationships with academia, there's a lot of ways to go about it. And so we kind of look at everything.
Fascinating. And what are your sources of data? You say transactions and who might be behind them and so forth. How do you ingest the information you need and where does it come from to do the analytics?
Yeah. And so we're really an aggregator in that sense. So we use our commercial sources, the typical subscription kind of products, news, open source or OSINT. The intelligence community is a great ally and partner, the interagency partners. So other governments, you know, will call and say, hey, we heard about this or have you seen this? And then lastly is commercial partners. We even have commercial partners and, you know, we do a lot of industry engagement. And that's one of the best sources for us to understand where the market is going, who's creating what and with whom they're interacting.
And what happens when you find something suspicious, say someone via a shell company in Great Britain who's actually Russian invests in Hypersonics R Us, for example, that's doing work with AFWERX?
Yeah, so that's where the secret sauce is made. You have various methods, but we try to pull them into the CFIUS framework. That's probably the easiest and most well-structured. But we have some cool authorities and capabilities elsewhere within government that allow us to really have a meaningful conversation and address the threat.
Do you find that sometimes the companies themselves don't realize that they've been invested in by people with bad intent?
You know, I would argue that's probably 50% of the time. I think, you know, companies are really focused on developing their product, making money. They might not understand that, to your point, that Canadian or British shell is actually something else. And then a lot of them don't understand how they fit into something like Made in China 2025. China does a very good job of telegraphing or, you know, explaining to its people what it's going after. And so they might say biotech or hypersonics. And so companies need to understand that, you know, we might make a widget in biotech that we don't think matters for national security. But if China or Russia is looking for it, you're in our orbit. You're part of the game now.
So basically, you're looking for people that would take our property from the front door and not the back door.
Yeah, I mean, we do look at the whole value chain, if you will, but I think that's a good way to frame it. I mean, it seems like we're doing all the work, we're spending the money, we're doing the research development, test evaluation, you know, commercializing the product, and then the bad guys show up at the last day, take it and get to steal all of our hard work, and we're getting pretty tired of it, I think.
Right. What I'm driving at is that they could become a board member or an investor and just simply have access to the information that way, as opposed to hacking in.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Board membership, investor relations, accessing data rooms through what seems like normal business transactions or a joint venture. So, yeah, they'll come in through the front door 100%.
We're speaking with David Rader. He's Deputy Director of the Office of Foreign Investment Review at the Defense Department and a finalist in this year's Service to America Medals program. And the category in which you're a finalist is Emerging Leaders, which is to say younger people coming into government. You're in your mid-30s. What in your background got you to this point and what attracted you to federal service?
I used to be in the Army in a previous life as an infantryman and, you know, had a great experience. All my best friends remain in the business. And so when I stepped away, I went to investment banking at JP Morgan and I was a M&A consultant at Ernst & Young. And so I enjoyed learning the commercial skills necessary, but I really missed that mission to service. When the opportunity presented itself, I was quick to jump on it because we're at a critical time right now where we need to better understand the commercial side and have better relationships and training, but also the Defense Department and national security in general and the U.S. government need really good dedicated public servants who are trying to bring in that next generation. And I was happy to be part of the team.
Did you get to the Army via enlistment or were you a ROTC or what was that path?
Enlisted right out of high school.
I'll be darned. So you've had J.P. Morgan and Ernst & Young level salaries in your short career, and now you've got a decent, but it's a Pentagon salary. What effect has that had?
There's some personal adjustments that had to be made.
But you're committed to it, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the best place I've ever worked. Seen such a diverse group of people from all over the country, you know, kind of all over the world come here to solve really meaningful problems, to watch over, you know, America, our investors, our innovators, our people. It's a cliche, but it's one of those, like, it gets you out of bed in the morning. I really enjoy it. And I have the best boss in the world and great colleagues. So that even makes it easier.
Yes. And are there any examples of things you've uncovered that you might be able to tell us about?
Well, sadly, we were quite on the quiet side of the business. There's quite a few, but I mean, everything that you can imagine where maybe sometimes deals don't go through or some of the things you'll read in the headlines. One of us is around there poking around.
Got it. By the way, you mentioned some of the other DOD and intelligence community elements that you collaborate with. What about the Securities and Exchange Commission, for example, or some of the civil side of government? Is that also part of the CFIUS apparatus?
Yeah, absolutely. We've expanded the scope because we've realized, you know, if you're looking at economics, it's ridiculous to not involve the Securities and Exchange Commission. I mean, they're the regulators for the markets, if you will. The Federal Aviation Administration, the FCC, you know, communication. I mean, kind of the whole panacea of government. We've had just excellent partners. Every time we pick up the phone and say, we have an issue, you know, we think it kind of fits into your authority bucket, but, you know, we like to collaborate and find a solution for our country. They've always said, yeah, come on over, or, you know, we'll be there on Monday. And it's gone really well.
David Rader is Deputy Director of the Office of Foreign Investment Review at the Defense Department and a finalist in this year's Service to America Medals program. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to see you, Tom.
We'll post this interview along with a link to more information at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe at Podcast One or wherever you get your shows.
Hello, I'm WIPA CEO Shane Canfield, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Lessons in Leadership. I'm honored to be joined by Angie Bailey, founder and CEO of Ananda Life. Angie has a remarkable career in public service, beginning as a GS-2 clerk typist with the Social Security Administration. And over the next 40 years, Angie steadily worked her way up through the government, ultimately becoming the Chief Human Capital Officer at the Department of Homeland Security. She's been recognized with presidential rank awards by two administrations, for leadership, innovation, dedication, and commitment to the country. Angie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Shane. What a pleasure to be here.
Angie, you've made quite a name for yourself as a leader in the federal workforce. Who was the first person you remember looking up to as a leader, and what about them inspired you?
You know, I often think about this because, you know, sometimes we think of the people that we look up to the most as being somebody that throughout our career has, you know, been at the highest levels and all. But, you know, I've got to go back to honestly whenever I was 10 years old. And I remember I really wanted to play Little League baseball on a boys team. I was the only girl. And interestingly, it was the women who would keep saying to me that, no, I couldn't play. And then one day, whenever I was there to sign up yet again, there was this guy, his name was Delbert Beiser. And I remember he had like red hair and he had a wad of tobacco in his mouth and greasy overalls and everything. And he said, you know, I'll take her on my team. And, you know, just looking back on that, there's so many leadership lessons and things that I just really admire about him. And actually, I thought about throughout my entire career. He took a chance on somebody he didn't know. He put aside whatever conscious or unconscious biases that he might have had about having a girl on a team. He treated me the same. Whether, you know, if I wasn't performing, I got benched just like the boys. I got no special treatment. And he was just really honest with me, and he just included me in everything. And so looking back on it, you know, really, it was Delbert Beiser, our local mechanic in our little small village, that was, I think, my inspiration for going on to, I hope, become the leader, you know, that I wanted to be.
I'd say half of the guests on this podcast have had similar stories where they reach back to either childhood or young adulthood. And I think as leaders, it's really incumbent upon us to keep that in mind, that what we say and do, especially in the younger ages, really can have a lifelong impact. How would you describe your leadership style, and how's that developed over time?
I would say that the one word that describes my leadership style is that I care. I guess that's more than one word, but I care. I've always cared about the mission. I've always cared about the people. I've always cared, you know, about making sure that they had what they needed, or that they were developing the way, you know, that they aspired to develop. And I tried to take this approach of not treating people the way I wanted to be treated, but instead treat people the way they want to be treated. And I think that really kind of developed over my career. You know, I started out just like most leaders do, where it's very results driven. It's all about the bottom line. You need to make sure that you get everything accomplished, because, you know, that's what everybody's looking for, the goals, the metrics, et cetera. But I think as you mature and you go along, you start to your point, you draw back on those early childhood days or early adult, young, you know, whenever you're a young adult, and you say, you know, I think that there's a little bit more to this than just the bottom line. And so over time, I really began to, I think, see a much bigger picture and the entire ecosystem, if you will, and how the people themselves fit into all of this. And that ultimately, at the end of the day, it was all about the people. And so I think my maturity allowed me to then shift and focus more on the people than so much on results and bottom line.
You've been recognized with two Presidential Rank Awards, two different administrations. You founded your own company. Tell us a little bit more about your background from the beginning, and how did that lead you to where you are today?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, like you said, that I started out as a GS-2 Social Security Administration. I mean, what I really wanted to be was a criminal prosecuting attorney. That was absolutely my dream. I sometimes joke and say what I really wanted to be was a mafia don, but that wasn't going to work out. So, you know, had to be a criminal prosecuting attorney. But, you know, I had to get a job to pay for college. It wasn't in the cards that I was going to be able to go to college without a job. So I applied at the at the unemployment office. And lo and behold, I got a job at Social Security. I didn't even know it was federal, to be honest. From there, I went to the Department of Defense, and I found this career field called labor and employee relations. And honestly, it was as close as I was going to get to being a criminal prosecuting attorney. I didn't go on to be a criminal prosecuting attorney, but I went on courtesy of Department of Defense to get both my bachelor's and my master's in leadership, because the whole study of leadership, I just find incredibly fascinating. You know, from historical to current times, it's just something that's just really fascinated me. And so I would say I'm a lifelong learner of leadership. And then I would say some of the other things that got me maybe where I am today is I never really said no to anything. If people asked me to take on a new challenge, even if I wasn't sure I was going to be successful at it, I would say, you know what, not sure this is going to work out, but more than happy to give it a try. And it always worked out. But I think giving things a try and just not saying no to opportunities is what really led from one position to the next. I feel like I was always rewarded for just stepping in or stepping up and taking on the challenges that sometimes no one else wanted to do.
Angie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Shane. It's such a pleasure. I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity. Thank you.
This has been the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm CEO of WEPA, Shane Canfield. Looking forward to talking to you next time.
This episode is brought to you by Zelle. Whenever you're sending money through an app or online, it's important to do it safely. Here are a few helpful tips. First, always make sure you know and trust the person you are sending money to. Second, confirm you have entered their contact details correctly. And finally, if you don't trust the person or your recipient is rushing you to send money right away, think twice before sending money through an app or online.
Grab a 30-day free trial of Live by Live Plus, and you'll get unlimited skips, commercial-free music, and all of the podcasts and live streaming events you can handle. Visit livexlive.com/podcast1 to learn more and start your free trial.